Fred, I would like to dedicate this day to basically looking a little closer at the concept of mindfulness, at how we understand that, how Buddhist teaching understands that, how Western psychology tries to understand that, how we understand that. We, meaning people who are not living at the feet of the Buddha, who are living in the 21st century, come to think of it, and who do not think of themselves in terms that are used in Buddhist teaching. We think of ourselves, I would expect most of you think of yourselves in terms of psychological notions. Yeah. One of the things that they're very, very different from now than in the days of the Buddha is that since about 80, 90 years, psychological concepts have made inroads into popular thinking. Right with the beginning of psychoanalysis in the first part of the 20th century, we have started to think of us, of our experience in terms of psychological concepts. This wasn't the case. Franz Kafka didn't think that way. Yeah, if you bother to read Franz Kafka, he did not use psychological concepts. Goethe didn't. Shakespeare didn't. Yeah, these people were not speaking in psychological concepts. All of them were very psychological people. They wrote about psychological things and processes, but they did not use psychological language. Yeah. If you care, have a look at something that is 100 years old. Yeah. Well, you speak of interior experience, but you don't use psychological concepts. You won't find any psychological concept in Franz Kafka's work. He doesn't speak about neurosis. He doesn't speak about anxiety. Yes, but read how he reads about anxiety. You know, he doesn't actually use these concepts. Okay. Yeah. He doesn't speak in terms of a self. Yeah. His notion of a relational experience is starkly different. As close as these old writers come when they speak about dreams. Yeah. If you read a character description in Goethe or the description of an inner state, you know, it's very, very different than most people today would describe how they feel when they go to the psychotherapist. Yeah. So there's a break here in culture. There are many more breaks. If we go back to the Buddha, we're basically 2,500 years away from here. Yeah. Chava, please. So, one of the issues we have when we try to find out what the Buddha meant by mindfulness is that we don't think and we don't speak in the same way about experience. Not just about the experience of mindfulness, but about experience, full stop. Yeah. Think of something that you know from the days of the 4th century BC. Yeah. What do you think? What do you read about things from the 4th century BC? Anywhere, frankly. Yeah. Ever had a look at a Greek play? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Aristophanes? 4th century BC, a contemporary of the Buddha. Know some of his plays? If you have a look, you'll find out that it's quite difficult to understand the guy. Yeah. His jokes are not always funny. In fact, you don't even notice that they're jokes at all. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's so far away from us. It's so specific to Greek society of 4th century that we cannot even get the point, yeah, let alone the choke of the point. Yeah. So if we want to understand Aristophanes and how he made fun of his society, we need to think. Not what this sounds to us, but we need to think of what this meant to him. Yeah. The same way we have to proceed when we want to understand what the Buddha meant by something like mindfulness, we need to actually go back and look. Where did he get his terms from? What did this mean? What were his examples like? How did he relate that to the context? It's not the text, it's the context that makes really the meaning. You with me on that so far?
Yes.
I'll give you an example, very stark example. Buddhist teaching in the West was very early on branded as being pessimistic. Western scholars kind of reading Buddhist and it's all about suffering and there is no self and there is no God. Yeah, God, what a sad, sad, pessimistic religion, you know. No self, no God, just suffering. Buddhists, really serious people, really serious people. No? Because religion, for most people who were studying Buddhism in the 19th century, you know, religion was about God. That's the religion they know. It's the religion of Jesus, it's the religion of Moses, it's the religion of Muhammad. Yeah, it's theistic religion. So a religion without God was suspicious to start with. It wasn't even a religion. Yeah? Can there be religion without God? So many Western people decided Buddhism can't be a religion because it doesn't have a God. If you're a genuine Buddhist, this is a very strange way of thinking. Yeah. If religion is that which makes people free and happy and awake, then you better do without a God, actually. Yeah. So, when they studied about Nibbana, highest happiness of Buddhists, yeah, summum bonum in Buddhist teaching, Nirvana, Nibbana. What is Nibbana? Yeah, so they go, Sanskrit is, they look at the word root. Sanskritists love word roots. You know, finding out meaning of things means you go to etymology and context. Okay, you have two meanings of the word nibindati, cooling down, yeah, or nirveti, yeah, finally disappearing. One is kind of calming, cooling. One meaning is cooling down. There's a theory which says that Nibbana was a household term at the time of the Buddha. You know, mummy would say to the kids, Nibbana the rice down, it's still too hot. You know? The other theory says, the other word in the root from Nirvana is to be extinguished. You know? So like a flame is extinguished. So something that goes out, a flame going out, a fire being extinguished. And then you have a couple of examples in the scriptures itself, where it says that she has understand the nature of desire, and the desire has gone out like a flame without fuel. Yeah. There's a poem from Patajara, and then you know Western philosophers and scientists think, oh God, this is really sad. Buddhism, what they want is extinction. Yeah, extinction. They think disappearing. Extinction in Hebrew, please. Yeah. Basically end, yeah? End, finish. Extinction, yeah. This is how we think. A fire that is extinguished is a dead fire. It has stopped existing. It's kaput. It's dead. Yeah. Now, so they concluded Buddhism not just very, very pessimistic. It's about suffering, no God, you know, no soul, and all preoccupied with dukkha, yeah, with suffering and unsatisfactoriness. That's bad enough. But now, the best thing they can think of is basically extinction. Yeah, yeah? It's dead. Yeah? So Buddhism, really serious religion. First they take away God, then they take away the soul, then they make us suffer, and then at the end they say, the best thing that can happen to you is extinction. Yeah? So, wow, who wants to join there? Now there's a little problem with this, because, you see, the Indian notion of fire, which is the context of the notion of nirvana, yeah, of going out. Yeah? The context of the notion of nirvana is the image of fire. Now, the image of fire is not in the word. Yeah. So, by accurately translating the word, you don't translate the context. So, the context in Indian thought, in Vedic thought, is you have Agni, the fire god, yeah, the deity of the fire element personified in the god Agni as he appears in old Vedic text and as he appears in ritual practices. Some of you may have seen a fire puja in India. which you can see right from, you know, the earliest Rig Veda texts, right down to Tibetan practices, which still do fire pujas, yeah. Or you may see the fire ritual from Raj Yoga practitioners. So, God Agni has many ways of manifestation. You know, one form of manifestation is visible. Yeah. Is visible to the human eye. Yeah. And then there's another form. If a fire goes out and if a fire is extinguished, then the God, the deity Agni, is not gone. Yeah. He has just become invisible. Yeah. He has gone out from manifestation into latency. He has moved from the visible form realm into the invisible, unspeakable realm. But he's still there. He's still alive. Yeah. So if the god Agni goes out, yeah, he doesn't die. He's not extinguished. It continues, but it becomes unspeakable. You understand? Very different story. Same word, same translation. But if you refer that word going out, nirvana or nibbana, as it is in Pali, if you refer that to the going out of something who just becomes unspeakable or numinous, yeah, you have a very different image than if you think of a fire that is poured over with water and that stops burning and is dead. Yeah. So in Western minds, even though the translation was accurate, the image was dead, extinct, finished. Yeah. The Indian mind, the notion of nirvana was not dead, finished, extinguished, but has gone beyond the realm of the sayable. It can no longer be described. It is no longer manifest in ways visible to the eye, knowable to the mind. Yeah. Yeah. So this is a very small example of how, although we can translate accurately the words, actually the context of the words determines the meaning and can really make a big, big distinction. So for the Indian mind, the notion of nirvana was not the death of everything we knew, everything we know and see and feel and experience. But it is going someplace we have no access to in terms of our current experience. It's transcendent. It's not dead. Yeah. That's a very big difference. So let me switch back to sati. Mindfulness is a big thing. You probably know, how many of you have to do with MBCT and MBSR trainings? Yeah. Mindfulness-based stress reduction, mindfulness-based cognitive therapy. How big are they in Israel? Can you give
not
me?
Big.
Not big.
At all.
Not big at all. But it's coming? Is there interest?
Yeah.
Are there other therapeutic schools who are using mindfulness in Israel? Dialectical behavioral therapy?
Yes, a little bit.
Yeah.
Beginning.
Any other things? ACT, acceptance-based therapy?
What's
no?
ACT, accepting?
Acceptance-based therapy. Forgive me, I'm not clued up. Most of my life I'm not here, so I need to get a feel for what you hear about mindfulness. Because these are...
Focusing, I see.
Focusing.
Hakomi, very strong in Israel.
Okay, focusing, yeah.
Hakomi,
yes. Other branches of psychology or psychotherapy that use mindfulness here in this country?
Corona Institute. Teaching.
Good. Corona Institute, yes. Any other?
Transpersonal psychology a little bit.
Yeah. Are they teaching explicit mindfulness or?
Sometimes.
Yeah.
It's more about the teachers now these days than the system.
Well, as you're probably aware, this is a growing movement in many psychotherapeutic modalities, that mindfulness is increasingly emphasized in various schools, and obviously many practitioners, many psychotherapeutic or psychological practitioners have personal meditation experience now for many years, and are wishing to bring that experience somehow into their practice, you know. By discrete ways, by simply practicing mindfulness without telling anybody, yeah, and just trusting that there is a good effect in their therapeutic setting, or by recommending such practices to clients or patients, or if the patient explicitly wishes this, you know, let's say Sai In Focusing, where people explicitly teach forms of body awareness as part of the actual focusing exercise, you know, there's transmission of particular skills or particular attentional focus handed over in a therapeutic setting or in a psychological setting. There is also a great popularity of that in the English-speaking world, particularly in the French less, in the German more, but a huge amount of interest from many corners. So one corner is obviously insurances, who think that this is cheaper than drugs, yeah, who love this kind of thing because it seems more cost-effective. There is an interest in terms of, you know, the psychiatric institutions, because they realize some of their issues can be handled very effectively. Yeah, depression, anxiety, and pain respond very well to even rudimentary forms of mindfulness practice. This is documented. You have numerous amounts of tests which prove, quote unquote, the validity of mindfulness approaches. Something about these tests maybe later. And there are individual practitioners who find their own mindfulness practices very precious, and they would like to make use of that in their therapeutic work. So there are a number of people who speak about awareness, mindfulness, types of attention, you know, from very early on. So in the West, the history of mindfulness begins, well, don't really know. Maybe with the gradual distinction of what attention is, you know, in that starts with the Greek somewhere, and then the Christian tradition has made some distinctions in the 12th century between a type of attention that is evoked by stimulus, the outside, you know, simply involuntary attention that is kind of called upon by anything sudden, anything strong, anything pleasurable, anything new, anything moving, anything dangerous. You know, this is kind of generally evocative of my attention. Something happens and ding, my attention goes there. I don't have to choose, it just goes there. And then the scholastics started to distinguish that from another type of attention, which is voluntary, which is directed, which has to do with my choice, with my intention to go there with my attention. And this distinction is very early on, is there in the West, but not many tricks are there to cultivate attention. So James writes a whole chapter, William James writes a whole chapter about attention in 1890, and devotes much thought to it, and he says, we all know what attention is. It's the opposite of distraction, fragmentation. It's the choice that we make to bring our attention to one, the fullness of our mind to one particular experience at the expense of other experiences. In other words, we focus. Yeah? We take away attention from some things that other things become more clear in our attention. How do you translate attention? Hebrew. I have a couple of words for you, just for fun. Yeah. I have one of them is tumet lev, obviously, and another one is keshef.
Keshef.
Yeah, I understand. So forgive my bad Hebrew. Tumet lev has something to do with the heart. Yeah, is that correct? And keshef has something to do with listening. Yeah. How about eranut? What do you make of this?
Kind of awakeness.
Like alertness. Alertness. Okay. Has that something to do with attention?
It's a factor of attention.
Okay.
Being awake. Eranut.
Yeah. How about Zehirut?
Zehirut?
Caution.
Does that have something to do with attention?
What's the word?
Faintly.
It's more like attention.
Attention.
Please.
Exclaim mark.
Uh-huh. How about Lehakir? Does that have something to do with attention? Good. We'll play with this a little more. One thing is that, you know, when talking about these things, we start from the concepts we are familiar with. Now, the word mindfulness, which is most famous word for what the Buddha called sati, is actually a strange word. Yeah. This is what the Buddha called a very primordial quality and function of mind. This primordial function of mind, I'll hope to explain a little better. But let me start with mindfulness. Mindfulness is a word that was more or less, it wasn't exactly invented, but it was used by the translator of English into English of early Buddhist texts, a man called Rhys Davids, and he started to use the term mindfulness in the late 1890s for exactly this word in Pali, for sati. Yeah. The word mindfulness does exist in English language, did exist in English language before that, but it was barely known. Yeah. It had no specific meaning, it was very diffuse in meaning. I found it somewhere in the 16th century as an English translation of the French word for thinking. So he used that word, we think, because he found a similar word in the Bible, in a common prayer book actually, where it says basically to be mindful of the needs of others. In other words, to be looking after others, be careful, in care for other people's needs. Yeah, that's how the prayer book, the common prayer book, uses the term. Be ever mindful of the needs of others. And we believe that Rhys Davids used the adjective and gave a new meaning to the word. He basically coined the term mindfulness in its Buddhist meaning. So this is a very good situation, because you basically have a word, nobody knows what it means, and you can give it meaning, yeah? This is an ideal situation for translators. In German, it's not so good. We use a very common word in German that has something that everybody believes they already know what it is. Yeah? That's a problem. And I suspect in Hebrew you have similar problems. Because as soon as you use words you already know, everybody instinctively feels, okay, I know what mindfulness is, you know. I know what tzumet lev is, or I know keshev is. You know? And it's very difficult to actually distinguish what was meant by that. You know? And then we stick with the meaning we know, we're familiar with, and we think that's it. You know? But that was just an approximation. You know? That was just what our translators found to the best of their abilities. Now, let us look a little bit closer at the term sati. Instead of bothering with German or Hebrew or English meanings, let's go back to what did the Buddha actually mean. He took that word. He didn't invent the word sati. The word smriti turns up in the Vedas already. Yeah? And it's much older than Buddhism. And the term is used for memory. It is used for recalling something. The capacity of the mind to recall what has happened a long time ago and to recall what has been said a long time ago. This is, by the way, not properly written. We could do that with proper dashes and so Sanskrit dashes. But this is how it's pronounced, smriti. And in the Vedic tradition, you had two lines. Yeah. Two lines of transmission. One of them was the Shrutis, teachings that you personally heard, yeah, from your teacher, from Shruti to hearing. And the other line of teaching was the Smritis. This is stuff that is handed down in the tradition, but you personally didn't hear it. Yeah. So, when Buddhists took over this term, for many, many instances, the term sati in Pali language is connected with the verb sarati, which simply means remembering. This is pretty much in agreement with the Vedic notion of the term. So, for example, the opposite of sati is mutasati. It means you're forgetful. Or somebody has a good memory. Say somebody like Ananda, who was famous for having a good memory, was the one foremost in the capacity of sati. He's the man whom we owe much to, because he asks many stupid questions. And as you probably know, when people have the courage to ask stupid questions, many people can learn, because many people don't have the courage to ask stupid questions because they're a bit afraid to look bad in public. But when somebody asks a stupid question, this is a good chance for many people to learn. Yeah. So Ananda was a little bit cocky sometimes. Do you understand cocky?
No.
Yeah, here.
Zachuach.
Okay, thank you. And he, you know, like many disciples, they not just like to ask questions, they like to show actually how much they already know. And then they receive compliments, you know. The expectation is the teacher says, yes, very well, exactly, this is the case. So Ananda occasionally asked a couple of questions, and the Buddha sometimes says, yes, this is true, and sometimes he says, no, Ananda, do not say so, this is not the case. Yeah. So Ananda had not just the courage to ask questions, which have given us many explanations of the Buddha, of which we know, but also he had an excellent memory. He was the person who, at the first council, that's shortly after the Buddha died, 3 months after, recited, upon being questioned, many, many of the texts which we know as Buddhist discourses now. Yeah. So the Abhidhamma teachings, which are dealing more specifically with analytical and psychological and some philosophical concepts, it's an attempt to make an ethical philosophy, which is an interesting attempt, but I will only touch that very tangentially. The Abhidhamma also uses the term sati very much in the sense of sarati, yeah, in the sense of remembering. Now, there is one big context in Buddhist teaching which does not use the term sati in the sense of memory or recollection or remembering. And that is the context of the Satipatthana teaching. That is the context of establishing mindfulness. Yeah. Now remember, sati has a number of... We can have a look at sati in a number of ways. I would like to have a look at it. Let's do that orderly. I would like to have a look at its role, its function, its images, and its challenges. Yeah, those four aspects I would like to go through with you today. Right now, I'd like to stop quickly and say, are we clear so far? Yeah. We have a central quality of mind that is both a function and the root for both inside. Sati is indispensable for wisdom, for vipassana, and the result of vipassana, namely panya, wisdom. Sati is indispensable for stillness of mind, for samadhi, for the practice of absorptions, The deep states of calm depend on sati being present and trained. Sati is necessary in basically staying normal. If you have no sati, then you're not just having emotional problems or spiritual problems, you're actually having mental problems, just to be clear. So all of you have some degree of sati, otherwise you simply wouldn't have made it here. It's not a lofty quality, it's not a high quality, it's not extraordinary. You have to think of sati as an everyday function of mind. So let me just chop that very quickly down. So, indispensable for calm, wisdom, so these, the roles of sati in the development of samadhi and in development of panya are not quite the same. Let's call that properly here. This is an interesting term called sampajanya, which basically means I'm capable of making references of my sati to value systems, usefulness, efficiency, appropriateness, this kind of thing, This is a very major aspect we sometimes forget in the development of sati. I mean, you're happy to write that all down, but one thing I suggest, maybe some of you have a mobile phone camera and we could snapshot them and mail them around at the end of the course. That's often what people like to do. So if that's possible, if you miss one of the things or so, don't panic. It could be just mailed to you at the end of the course. Maybe we share out our mailing list, and if somebody wants to use his handy camera, his mobile camera, and snapshot this, we can do that. This is an interesting domain. This is how sati has its everyday life application. It means it. Sati in itself is not an ethical quality, although the Abhidhamma claims opposite. It is not purpose-oriented. So to make use of sati in everyday life, we need to connect it with both experiential knowing, we need to connect it with relational knowing, with ethical knowing, with purposefulness, and with efficiency. That's how sati makes our everyday life better. That's why people like to meditate, because they become more aware, where the milk goes in the morning when they try to pour it in the tea, or they remember phone numbers better, or things like that. In Buddhist mind development, sati is the root quality, basically, for all developments of wisdom, developments of stillness, developments of everyday functionality, and what I just noticed, I forget, the development of sila. This is our ethic response to the world. Ethics, morality, the relational, social aspect of our practice. For all these four domains, sati is important. Now, in other words, there's no way you can get around this. There's no way that we can miss out on that one. There's probably no other quality of mind so central in Buddhist teaching than this one. If you
doesn't work. We'll need to work on this concept here.
So sati turns up, if we look at its role in the Buddhist teaching, sati turns up, it is, it's in the Noble Eightfold Path, yeah, that's the Buddhist therapeutic part of his Four Noble Truths, yeah, that's the Eightfold Path. Sati is right up there as number 7, sammasati, yeah. Then we have sati is one of the 5 spiritual faculties, one of the 5 basic virtues that reign or that govern any spiritual development. You know, it's the middle one. Satindriya. Is in spiritual faculties. Very famous list. Sati is the first one of the awakening factors. Yeah. Sati Bhojanga. In the monastic discipline, you have sati, interesting, as a, it's one of the ways of stilling dispute. Any realistic discipline needs to come to terms with the conflicting human mind. So any group discipline basically needs to have some tools in place how conflicts can be quelled. So in the monastic discipline, sati turns up as one of the principles by which conflicts can be pacified. Yeah. Just, this is maybe less important, but just write it down. I do think everyday life has something in common with monastic life, and things that help us still in conflicts may be of interest, both for your social, your marital, and your political life. I'm sure you understand the value of this. So, in many ways, sati is in the top charts of Buddhist list making. Yeah. It's in there. There is no question that this is an important faculty. It is rated part of the training, part of the virtues that make the training possible and that should be strengthened. It is very specifically part of those faculties that help the mind to actually wake up, that make the awakening quality possible. Sati is also not in the hit list, but it's indispensable in 2 other qualities which have to do with our ethical development, and these are both, they're called hiri and otapa. One is the quality of conscience. How would you say that?
Matsupon.
Yeah, it's the sort of institution we get in trouble with if we do things we know are not good, yeah, on the inside. And otapa is the outside. This is the sort of institution we get in trouble with. Our cultural context may have strong opinions about our behavior. Yeah? So hiri is the fear what happens to us if we don't act nobly, if we don't act in ways we know better. Otapa is the fear we have what our culture, our subculture, our religious or peers will think and reproach us if we don't live up to moral standards. Yeah, ideally they overlap. Often they don't. Yeah. Often our peers may find different things are. They may have different expectations of me than I have of myself. Yeah. I'm a bicycle driver in Germany, and there are certain laws governing the use of bicycles in Germany, and I personally might find driving against the direction of the road is perfectly legitimate in my own sense of moral understanding. I don't have any compunctions about driving at night in the wrong direction through the road. If I don't see any cars in there and this is the shortcut to my home, I find no moral difficulties doing so. But police who sees me may find. Yeah. So this is a very simple example where my personal sense of moral integrity allows me to drive up the wrong road of the road. But police officers may have a different thought about this. So this would be an example of a clash, that my hiri is perfectly okay with my action, but the otapa bit, the state bit, is not okay with my behavior. This may be a little less harmless, you know, if it comes to, say, joining the army, or and you have personal feelings that you shouldn't do that, or but your state has the feeling that you should do that, or your religious community may think the way you should marry, they have very clear plans for you, and you personally have different plans for yourself. Yeah, so there is a lot of possibility for pain in the fact that my personal sense of conscience and what is expected from me where I live is different. Yeah. So sati is bringing us in contact with these qualities as well. Hiri, sense of shame. Otapa, sense of fear of consequences is maybe better. Sati is what makes me aware of these things, yeah? So this is just a minor point. And in so doing, sati helps basically a form of ethical moral development. Okay, let's call that sati, the lists. Yeah, then we get, this is the notion, the role of sati in the teaching, so it's big, yeah? Please.
In that context, in everyday Nepalese, which is probably driven from Fali, it's you use it as a word for friend. This is your, it's funny that you say it also about social aspects.
Sati.
Sati is what you say, my friend, your friend. Not marriage friend, my good friend is sati.
In Nevari language?
In the Nevari language, yes.
Okay, interesting. I'm not sure whether there is a etymological link. Yeah. But interesting to see. Yeah. Thank you. Can I ask, are we clear so far?
To read from here, otapa, and then I don't see otapa.
Fear of social consequences.
Okay.
Yeah.
Is it possible to write only in blue because the red is
okay.
Small and large.
Good. I'll confiscate the blue one here. Yeah? So we have sati, basically, according to the list, necessary for development of wisdom, development of stillness, development of ethics, and turns up development for everyday conventional appropriateness, and a few small points, yeah, like quality for sati as a quality for stilling conflicts, And sati is something which makes us aware of our impact, both internally in terms of consciousness and also externally in terms of social consequences. So in other words, sati is just about indispensable for every major development point in Buddhist teaching. Oh, I forgot. Sati is also inevitable for the development of the Brahmaviharas, of the four forms of universal empathy. Yeah? The way you cultivate empathy is by developing sati. So we have it really for just about every aspect of development, sati is needed. Good. Questions to this so far? Yes, please.
I didn't get how you get from sati as remembering to sati as a faculty of the other. What's the connection?
Well, the connection is basically Buddhist creativity. The Buddha redefined the term. Yeah. If you look at the teaching of this development of sati, yeah, which this is how samasati, the practice of right mindfulness in the Noble Eightfold Path, is invariably defined. Yeah, it is always defined as the development of the four foundations of mindfulness. In other words, or as I would like to translate it, the four forms of cultivating presence of mind. And these four forms are basically becoming aware and being capable of following in a continually attentive way physical sensations and bodily somatic states. It is identifying feeling tone and being able to discern feeling tone, being able to follow feeling tone. Identifying mind states, affective qualities of your experience, plus a few other states like scatteredness or stillness, degrees of intentional qualities like anger or greed or happiness, and the last one, the Dhammanupassana, the fourth channel basically for the development of sati, which is patterns that are particularly useful or particularly not useful for developing mind, like the hindrances, the nivarana, or the awakening factors like the bhujanga. So samasati, and you have to think of this, there are about 80 texts referring to satipatthana practice, so it's not something that is handled, you know, marginally. Yeah, it's central. Samasati is always defined as the practice of four satipatthana, and if you look at these practices, the four satipatthana don't make sense in terms of memory. You know, you don't memorize your breath. Yeah. It's very, very clear that this is the Buddha's way of redefining the term sati, and this is one of its most creative and one of most innovative efforts of early Buddhism to psychologizing the notion of sati from a mnemonic term. Mnemonic, anybody help in Hebrew? Mnemonic, M-N-E-C.
It's a koan.
It's connected with memory, yeah. So to an attitudinal quality, namely capacity of the presence of mind, yeah? Which I think Rhys Davies captured that very nice with his mindfulness as the full presence of the mind's capacity to be with something. So, yes, did I respond to your question? So we have two strands of interpretation, basically a Vedic, which is taken over for half of Buddhist teaching. In many contexts, sati simply means not forgetting. Yeah. And then there's another one which is defined as right mindfulness, explicitly suggested as the training. And the basis for all this stuff I was just talking about which is the cultivation of directed, focused attention on four aspects of our experience, you know, somatic, hedonic, in terms of pleasure and pain, affective, in terms of emotion and intention, and cognitive, in terms of thoughts and images, patterns of thoughts and images. So this is the definition we are probably most familiar with. This is the definition of sati that seems to have struck with most Western people, a deep chord. This is what we want to do when we go on meditation retreats. We want to learn to develop that kind of sati. You know. Most people don't want to memorize things. They're very, very reluctant to even memorize poems, let alone Buddhist teachings, you know. So I'm not sure whether this is the case here in Israel as much as elsewhere, but the memory capacity seems to drop, you know, in people. We all prefer clicking icons and pressing buttons, virtual ones and literal ones, but we've become a very visual culture. You know, there's a dramatic shift the last 50 years from textual to visual culture, and that comes with great disadvantages for actually remembering things. Yeah. Indian culture is totally different. Yeah. You know, even until very recently, Indian culture, or even many other Asian cultures as well, they're basically, the stuff you knew was only the stuff you knew by heart. Yeah. So if you needed a book, let alone a computer or a Wikipedia, basically you didn't know it. Yeah. So knowing means knowing by heart, certainly in the Buddha's days. And the Buddha didn't invent that. It was the Vedic tradition which invented that. So knowing by heart meant learning by heart something. Good. Of you.
I have the question.
Yes, please.
First one, it seems like very understandable that sati connected to samadhi, but is sati connected directly to panya, or it's connected to samadhi and samadhi lead you to panya?
No, it's connected directly. there's an indirect connection via the degree of stillness that makes your mind more transparent, more receptive. But sati is also directly connected to panya via investigation, research, via vimamsa, dhamma vijaya, yonisomanasikara. All three terms have to do with specific forms of investigating, ruminating, researching, pondering, fathoming. This kind of activity is very directly connected to panya, not just via stilling of mind and then intuitive wisdom, but actually researching, systematic, methodical curiosity. Yeah, this is directly connected. These are very important things. That's one of the gifts of early Buddhism, the emphasis on this. You know, it's not just that you get insight or wisdom through sitting still. You get insight or wisdom through paying attention, through being curious, through asking questions, through studious investigation, you know, close observation, methodical interest in something. Yeah. Does that make?
Yeah. And the second question, can you define the difference between mindfulness and awareness?
I was hoping to come to that a little later. Can we
park
that one? And we need a little bit more flesh around this one, yeah? Because that takes us into the next stage. Please?
It is a connection to the remember. If it makes connection, is that you remember these qualities when you make practice. Not as the manual, but as the qualities.
You remember to be present.
Well, that's one of the links. I think both of you are right. There's a very simple connection as well. When sati is present, your capacity to memorize and to remember is improved a lot. So if you're mentally present with sati, then at a later stage you have a better chance of recalling that event if in the first event you were present, you were endowed with sati. If at the moment you want to actually remember, you also have sati, it's even better. So sati basically transports the memory much more easily. It helps the memory imprint. Yeah. So the imprinting, neural imprinting of the event on your mind, then it facilitates the recalling process. That's, I think, one obvious connection. Sati not as memory, but sati as something that facilitates memory a lot. And then sati has one major function, which we all know from practical experience, is we remember that we have forgotten something. Yeah. You sit here, you do mindfulness of breathing, you know, and after 10 minutes, suddenly you hear a kind of motorcycle going through, moment of annoyance, and then you remember, hey, didn't I start off? There was something. Yeah? This is indoor. Hello, meditation, Buddhism, retreat, breath. That was it. Breath. We started with the breath. Yeah. And I have lost my breath. I have lost 10 minutes now. I have lost that breath. So sati has the capacity to recall what has been lost. And in that is what helps us to bring the mind back to what is being lost. Yeah. This is one of the major functions. I don't have a proper word for this in English, to be honest with you. I don't know what you would call that in Hebrew. I have a good German word, so I'm sure most of you know German. It means Vergegenwärtigung. Yeah? It's kind of bringing something back into the present. It's a very beautiful old-fashioned word which you can barely use anymore because people grow beards when you say it. But it precisely does that job. You know, it's a recollection of something that was lost and it's being thereby brought back into the present forefront of your mind. Yeah.
It's like if you say that someone lost his memory so he doesn't have something that was either that was an accident, someone lost his memory.
Do you mean that in a clinical sense of amnesic, or do you mean that you just slipped your mind? Yes, definitely. In Thailand, you would just say, Thai language uses the term sati, just for forgetful of something, ka sati, just I had a slip of memory, you know, I had a lapsus, something left my mind. Yeah. Please.
How about concentration?
Well, let me start. Let me give a little rant. Concentration is a very bad word to start with. We should be very careful with that word. It doesn't really do much good in Buddhist teaching, to be honest. It has a Latin root, you know. It implies concentric movements and it sounds dreadfully strenuous. You know, you always break out in sweat when you say concentrate or concentration. Also, it gives completely wrong impression. It actually gives the impression you can do it. Yeah. It gives the impression I can use this as a verb and I say to you, concentrate. Yeah. And then you do something and it happens. Yeah? There's no such concept in Buddhism for that.
Well, something in that neighborhood.
Yeah. Well, if you look at what jhana is described as, or if you practice and you experience your mind becoming more still, then you will know that this has nothing to do whatsoever with the attempt to concentrate. Yeah? The activity you try to do when you try to concentrate is very, very different from the activity that leads to experience of jhana. The activity that you do when you wish to collect your mind and lead it to the experience of jhana has to do with a certain amount of discipline, namely in bringing back the mind from its distraction. It has a lot to do with the choice of a suitable object of mind. It has a lot to do with patience, with softness, with gladness of mind, with capacity to generate welcoming interest for the object of your meditation. And then you try to not inflict your will on your mind. This is what I understand concentration to be doing all the time. So if you want jhana, don't concentrate, because you can't keep up concentrating. It's very painful, it takes a lot of energy, it's full of will, It makes the mind angry and unhappy, and that's the last thing which will lead to jhana. This is my opinion. The term you're probably looking for is something like unification. Yeah. Jhana is a unified experience. It is something the mind does. It's not something you tell it to do. Yeah. It does it because it likes it. It does it because it's gifted, it can do it, and it does it because it knows how to do it. If you do the preparatory ground, this is what's happening. It's like planting a seed. You know, you do the planting, you do the watering, you keep away the snails, you cut back the weeds, and then it grows.
She asked.
I'm telling that not to you. You know, I'm telling that to everybody. I'm conscious because the term concentration is one of the most misleading terms. And it evokes a lot of attitudes, particularly will attitudes, which are very detrimental to actually the practice of stillness, for which I hope you understand I have a great deal of interest and a great deal of value for this. But it's something that takes place in a different setting. It's like, you know, the growth of the plant you have planted, or the seed for which you have planted, is not something you decide. It's the plant that decides. Yeah? It's inherent in your mind how fast or how fruitful that grows. But when you want it to grow, you give it water, you give it earth, you keep away the animals, and you make sure it gets enough sun, and you cultivate. But the speed of growth and the size of growth is not in your hands. Yeah. And concentration seems to imply, actually, if I just have enough willpower and enough control, I can do it. And it's very misleading.
So
the relationship between what the Buddha calls samadhi, yeah, which I call calm or unification or stillness of mind, is crucial. It's the stability aspect. I hope to come to that in a moment. The stability aspect of sati, when emphasized, grows into the stillness aspect of mind, of samadhi.
That's interesting. It's not the other way around. It's not like the stillness is like the
ground.
The ground for sati, but the other way around.
Yeah, it's the other way around. See, sati is an everyday function. Right now you have some degree of sati. But samadhi is a highly conditioned state and is much more dependent on surrounding factors. Yeah, you need to be reasonably healthy, it needs to be reasonably still, you need to be having some talent, you need to have some strength, you need to have some good conditions for samadhi to arise. Sati, you can be practicing under very bad conditions. You can be in pain, you can be angry, you can be in many people. It's easier if you're not in pain, if you're with nice people, if you feel good, but you can still practice sati even if it's bad. Yeah. For samadhi, you need a lot more controlled environment, a lot more favorable conditions. So samadhi is the result of sati. It's the result of a continuity in sati, to be more specific. Since we all have sati, we wonder why don't we all have samadhi? But you see, the magic thing about sati begins when sati becomes continuous. Right now, most people, sati is episodical. Yeah, it's punctual. It goes to particular things. Yeah, like this. Now, if this development of sati is continuous, then some dramatic things start happening. One of them is the stilling of mind sets in. Yeah, we become more calm. We become more aware. We become more receptive for insights, and the mind begins to enjoy this experience, and this enjoyment helps the mind to become further still. Yeah. So this is what the Buddha calls samadhi. Basically the word he uses is unification, ekodibhava, becoming one, or ekagata, being one-pointed. The images he uses in his text are all connected with, often with water. Yeah, so the element of cohesion is the imagery for samadhi, not the element of concentration. You know,
the element of cohesion.
What is cohesion?
Cohesion is Physical principle?
L'echidut.
Surface of water, for example, has cohesiveness, yeah. It's the water element, you know. Drops of water sitting in the same vessel, they're not sitting in each corner and say, I have nothing to do with the guy over there. They kind of merge, yeah. You with me on this? This is cohesion, yeah. The hanging together.
It is Sarah called the samadhi gatheredness of mind.
Yes, wonderful. Yes, wonderful. Gathering is a very nice word. It's precisely that. So it's not something you order the mind to do, or you force it to do, but it's you invite it. And if it's good tempered, it follows. And sometimes it says no. Yeah. Can I suggest we make a break? Some of you will probably wish to go to the loo. Last question?
The same question.
Good.
I think my question is much more concrete and simple than what I meant. Or what. The relation, I'm lost with words now.
Yeah, good.
I see no words I use is what I mean. But
yeah.
My simple question is, if I need some amount of, I don't know how to say it, not concentration, but, you know, focus.
Yeah.
In order to be mindful, in order to listen to my breath, an example, if I'm very absent-minded, okay, or something like that. So this is what I meant.
Can I park your question? Take it up later. I love to take it up later. Maybe some in our second part this afternoon. Right now, I feel we need to take a little break. Come back in 15 minutes.
5 or 15?
Can you do 5?
10.
Can you do 10? Okay, let's do 10. 5 to 11 back in here, yeah? Thank you.